session number 10601, Rule 7.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 7. I was asking you about the start of the Second World War and to what extent were you aware that war would break out in 1939? Did you feel it would?
Yes, well, it was always in the air. Then, of course, when Germany attacked Poland and scrapped the Polish corridor, as I say, we knew then that was obvious we'd be involved. And, of course, things started to take shape. Within the barracks, there was the masking of lights and the painting of windows, blackout precautions, our uniforms. We had to take off the regimental buttons and replace them with the universal buttons. That was so that if we were captured, they wouldn't be able to recognise what regiment we're from, handing our cab badges. And, of course, the paint and camouflage and vehicles. I remember my motorbike was nicely, highly polished, olive green. And the next time I saw it was a mess. It was being decorated with a dull camouflage paint. I didn't like it one little bit. And, of course, our equipment was changed. The bayonets had to be handed in. They were highly polished like chrome, and in return we got these blue steeled bayonets. Again, we didn't like that. But we're gradually departing from peacetime way of life into wartime, and all these little things were upsetting, you know, to the professional soldier. They were, it had to be done. And as time went on, our kit was sorted out. Certain implements we wouldn't require on active service. And
what implements were those? Can you remember?
Mirrors, for instance. Everything which would give off light, like reflection of a man shaving, you know, which was ridiculous, really. And because the man still had to shave. And when you look back now and think of all the silly things we did, like had no cab badges in so they wouldn't know what regiment we belonged to. And it's marked down in your pay book. You see? Things like that. And as I say, we hadn't have any mirrors in our kit because it might cause a reflection in the sunlight and things like this. But as time went on, we got used to this sort of thing, even to a point whereby our buttons, which we weren't supposed to polish, we did polish them. Because after a few days, they were black and tarnished. And you'll get one soldier would rub his buttons a little bit, you know, out of pride, and someone else would rub buttons. And eventually, we started polishing our universal buttons as we had polished our previous buttons. Then the cab badges started to sneak back in again. You know, people hadn't handed them in. And it eventually found its own balance. You know, we even went to France with cab badges in and polished buttons when we had to go to France. But all these little things in the first place was panic, actually. Digging air raid shelters around the perimeter of the barracks and things like that. Mounting anti-aircraft guns. You know.
All this was taking place still in 1939?
Yes, at Woking Barracks, Inkerman Barracks, still taking in preparation for war.
Did you feel that there was an air of panic at the time? Are you aware of that?
Oh, there was panic. There was no doubt about it. There was panic.
Can you recall any instances that you've talked about the physical changes in equipment and so on? Can you recall any further instances of that?
Well, I remember there was panic. What happened? They were testing the air raid siren in Woking itself, testing it. Of course, nobody had been informed about it. And when we heard it, everyone's diving in the slit trenches. You know, it was just a trial run. And you saw the panic then. It was like jumping off a sinking ship. And then the officers was going around, bussing about, getting things ship-shape. And you're being kept reminded, you know, you won't have to do this when you get across there. All this sort of thing, you know, you'd be better than that. Well, when we did go across there, we did nothing for 9 months. Everybody thought that when we did get across there, we'd jump off the boat with rifle and bayonets fixing and charge the enemy, sort of thing, you know. And when you look back and know, it was very primitive.
Can I just take you back a little bit? I asked you about how you expected war to break out. Can you recall the actual day that war was declared?
Oh, yes, very clear. Sunday morning, I was assigned to open the canteen and control the queue as a regimental policeman. And just as we were opening the canteen, it was announced on the Ready Fusion, as it was, that we're now at war with Germany. And really, I never got to the counter. I just turned smartly about and carried out previous instructions. That was, report to the orderly room on the outbreak of war. Because our bikes, you're talking about panic, our bikes had been ready on the barrack square days before this, packed ready to go. And we'd been forewarned, instructed what to do on the outbreak of war. Well, it had come, so we carried out those instructions. And I went to the orderly room, reported to the adjutant, and along with a few more. And I remember a chap called Martin McLean, who was a sergeant. And about six of all together reported. And we're given this buff bamboo rope. Now, this was my first dispatch in wartime. And I had to go from Woking across to a place called Nomade in France. That was a damn long way for your first dispatch, but that's where it ended up.
Can I just ask you before you continue with this story of this dispatch? You were describing earlier on about the changes that went on in the regiment. These had actually taken place before war was declared.
Oh yes.
So the regiment was
weeks before war was declared.
So the regiment was already preparing before war was actually.
Yes, packing cases was being packed and blankets being packed and necessary equipment required for the voyage. You know, packing cases marked not wanted on voyage, things like that.
What was your feeling about war being declared? What was your reaction to it?
Well, I was rather excited about it myself. I wasn't afraid of it. I was excited. It was an adventure. Of course, I was only a young fella. And I was just going to fulfil my obligations. You know, and I thought that something new, something different, something good, in my opinion, then.
Did you have any opinions as to, or had you heard any other people expressing opinions as to how long the war would last and what sort of war it would be?
Well, it was always the idea that it wouldn't last long in the first place. It was a foregone conclusion and not last till Christmas.
Did you think that yourself?
Yes. I thought we had nothing else to do but just get across there and sort them out, and that'd be it. Of course, I didn't know anything about war. I mean, probably a chap who fought in the First World War would have known different, the same as my opinion about the Falklands War. You could foresee what was going to happen. But at that particular time, I just thought, well, it won't last till Christmas, this. We'll just get across then, get them sorted out and come back again.
Were there any old soldiers still in the army who had experienced the Great War?
Yes.
We had
Sergeant Major Brooks, who had been in the First World War, as a sailor though. He was in the Navy in the First World War. We had a chap called Malabar, Lance Corporal Malabar, who was in the First World War. Colonel Yates himself was in the First World War. Major Beard, second commander battalion, he was in the First World War.
These were all senior officers, so you wouldn't ever come across them talking about, you know, what they believe would happen in this.
Oh no, he didn't discuss things. You weren't on those sort of terms with them.
Yeah, so you never actually heard anyone from who had experience of the Great War talking about what they felt about this war.
No, because there's only Sergeant Brooks, and he was in the Royal Navy, and I think he joined the latter end of the war. And Corporal Malabar, I don't know what part he took in the Great War. I never conversed with him much, but I never heard no comments from any old soldiers. I think it was just a cliche, a passing phrase when they said, you won't be able to do this when you get across there. They were just anticipating that you wouldn't do it. They didn't know. I hadn't experienced it. But what I did find was all these old soldiers who had been to India on Northwest Frontier and shouting the mouth off, you know, when I was on the frontier, they're all wanting to go sick. They're all looking for, you know, a grading, a medical grading. They didn't want to go. I knew that.
Was this a common occurrence?
Yes, I would think so. Common occurrence. Especially the old soldiers. And you found this later on in war itself. Those who had been wounded didn't want to go back, sort of thing, you know. This repeated itself all the time. Old soldiers, once they experienced it, wanted to be out of it.
Would you say the morale of the regiment was fairly high or low?
Oh, yes. They were all anticipating it, looking forward to it. And as a whole, because most of the battalion were young recruits, you know, and as I said, with experience, something different, which what they trained for. But it turned out entirely different to what anybody expected. We didn't think that would be laid up for 9 months doing nothing, Cold War. We never thought that for a start, you see. Then we never realised that we'd have to experience the roughest winter that France had ever experienced, 1940. It was terrible, cold. We didn't anticipate that.
No. Can I bring you back now to where we left off? You were given this dispatch to take to Nomain in France. Mm-hmm. What was your feeling when you had this envelope opened and you read what you had to do?
Well, again, I thought it was great. It was a challenge. But at that particular time, I didn't actually realise I was going to Nomain. In particular, we were told we were going to France, you see. Then Sergeant McLean came on the scene. He took charge of us. We started up and we left walking, Inkerman Barracks, and went down to Avonmouth.
Had you made any special preparations before you left?
Everything was all arranged. Our bikes was packed up, rations, even to cigarettes, Bob Martin's, all packed up, ready on the bikes.
What about dealing, you'd never been abroad, I take it, until this time. What about dealing with the French? Had you got any...
Oh, no, none whatsoever. We didn't know even the rate of exchange. How many francs to the pound or nothing.
You were given French money, were you?
No. We just went with money we had in our pockets.
Were you given any additional money to
No. What we'd given is a card. When we got to France, we were given a card to be handed to any gendarme in the event of not being able to get fuel, petrol for the bike. If we pulled up and run short of petrol, that was the only thing we got, a card written in English and in French, you know, supply the bearer with petrol, so-and-so. I forget the exact wording of it now, but when we went to a garage, you had any trouble at the garage, we just called a gendarme in, you know, and he had authorised the garage attendant to give us petrol.
How many of you were actually involved in this mission abroad?
About six of us.
Were they all regimental policemen?
No. No, there was... I was the only regimental policeman. There was two from the signals, and I think two from the mortar platoon. And there was Sergeant McLean, about six of us. But I was the only regimental policeman.
What area of responsibility was Sergeant McLean attached to? Was he just sergeant of a...
In charge of a section.
Section,
you know.
Yeah, I see.
He used to see it. Well, he was just a sergeant in charge of us. So, I mean, he got his orders from the adjutant to take us down to Avonmouth, mm-hmm. You see. Then, when we got on board ship, we then came under the ship's transport officer, you see, who'd come from another regiment, I don't know who he was. And when we docked at St. Nazaire, we came under the docking authorities, which again was a British officer. He was on that ship, just taking up his post as docking officer, ready for when the main body came across. He was aboard our ship, the docking officer. So what happened was, you went down to Avonmouth. The nets was laid out ready on the docks, and the motorbikes were slung aboard. Then you went aboard, and of course there was other troops from other regiments. So it was a troop ship, but it was the first troop ship to leave England for France for the Second World War.
Were you aware of that at the time?
No, these things didn't pass through your mind, and just later on, when you realised it. Then, of course, your docking centre's here, and this is where the docking officer came into his being, you see. When he got his office established, then it was discovered that we had to go to Nomain, because we had no maps. The signposts had all been pulled down in France, and you were just given a list of towns you had passed through, you know, like Orchies, Douai, Lille, Chantenay, you see, and finally Nomain, and you only had a list, and you had to stop and ask them in your best English, pidgin English or pidgin French, whatever you call it, where they just point to the name on the paper, you see, oh, blah, 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 blah.
Did you find it quite easy to find your direction?
Yes, because there weren't all main roads, you see. And of course, the main roads there were few and far between. You couldn't get mixed up with, say, like the Stamford Road and Pontylent Road running parallel. You know, they were just like single road and very minor third-class roads running off. Well, you knew you didn't want them. You just kept belting along until you saw a populated area. Well, this must be it. Oh, cheese, or whatever it is, you see. And when you stop and ask the gendarme, then you ask them how to get through the next town. You point it on your piece of paper, and he would give you... Of course, it's surprising how many people in France could speak English. Surprising. And then one thing in particular, when I was riding through a place called Orchies, I happened to glance up at a shop, a jeweller's shop, and there was my name, Cottier. Jeweller's shop.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did, very much.
What was the reaction of the French civilians? Did you come across any of them? You mentioned the gendarmerie.
Yes, well, the gendarmerie was all right. give us no trouble, we give them no trouble, and very helpful. But the people themselves, I never liked them, to be honest. A lot of them were anti-British, pro-German.
Did you get that impression straight away when you were over there?
More or less.
What gave you that impression?
Well, when you went to Stamany, a cafe, for anything to eat or a drink, and you go and speak in terms with the barmaids, as you know them, mademoiselles, they would say, "Ah, British soldier, Tribune, Tribune, ah, Bosch Tribune." They would say, must say, they would countermand that and say, "Ah, Bosch Tribune." And honestly speaking, they would prefer the Germans there to us. Lots of French people would have preferred the Germans to us. They were very unsociable. Mind, at the same time, we give them cause to be unsociable. One thing in particular, we were billeted in a farmyard, and there's just a hand pump for your water supply, and the troops themselves knew when they went there to get a wash, they had to fill a tin and take it about 20 or 30 yards away and wash there. But they weren't doing that. They were washing in the vicinity of the pump. Well, eventually the soapy water was seeping through into the well. Eventually, well, that wasn't good now. You know, you could understand that. Until they started locking up the pump, we couldn't get any water. And of course, if you went to the shops to buy anything, the prices were sky high. Charging enormous prices.
This, of course, is later on when the regiment was out.
Yes, that's later on, of course.
When you were first riding through,
I found them good, helpful. When I was first riding through, I found them good. They were waving, cheering. You know, and if you stopped your bike, put the bike on the stand, and go to a stand there for something to eat, you got a congregation around you. You know, and they would come and look at you, and especially the men folk with the equipment, you know, because they weren't arrested. Look at the motorbike and things like that, and try and talk to you in English and French. And, oh no, they were quite good. Very sociable at first, when you first went through. And even when you were riding through, they would wave as though you were a celebrity. Of course, we were an unusual sight. I mean, we were the first British troops there since the First World War. And I thought half of them didn't even recognise who we were.
You reached Namain. Mm-hmm. Is that right? How long did the journey take you?
About 2.5 days.
Where did you sleep on this journey?
Just on the roadside, with a ground sheet over you and a blanket. I could have used my charm, I suppose, and went to a farmhouse or a staminer. I could have just... And I think I would have been made welcome. But I didn't. It was lovely weather. And I just kept down on the roadside, Country Lane. And I remember when I was getting tired and weary of riding, I think, well, I'll pull off here and have something to eat, have a sack of rations, and keep down for the night. So I pulled off the main road, make my way into the country where I wouldn't be troubled or bothered. And as I'm riding along this country lane, I saw these hens crossing the road in front of me. You see? Well, I thought that by the time I get there, the noise of the engine will scatter them. You see? But behold, just as I got to that point, two hens came flying out, and one got fast in my front wheel and threw us. Of course, I was dazed, picked myself up, and that was the first time in my life that I fancied a cigarette. And I had some Bob Martin cigarettes in the pack with the rations. And I sat down and had a cigarette. And that was the first time I had a cigarette. And I was explaining this once to somebody about the hen. I says, "The hen scattered off the road." And I says, "The damn thing came back again." And this bloke says, "Ah, yes." He says, "If you watch hens, study hens, they go by the turbulence. He says, your machine sound would create a turbulence and direct the hen into your position, into your front wheel. You know?
That was just an unfortunate accident.
Unfortunate accident. And that was the first time I smoked a cigarette.
What about getting food? Was that
well, we had plenty with us. I did go to Staminay's. We had biscuits and tinned corned beef. Bread. Tea. Carnation milk. You know, we weren't hungry. And of course, there was fruit on the roadside. Peaches, which weren't supposed to pick off the trees. I was picking them, eating them. Which for some reason I was told that you weren't supposed to touch them. And of course I did corner a couple of Staminay's, so egg and chips.
What did you do when you reached your destination, which was No Mains?
I found this place called Chateau La Motte, a house called Chateau La Motte, which was my destination. And I had to see the resident owner and hand him this document. Well, the resident owner, I suppose, he was a member of the Civic Centre, probably a councillor, Lord Mayor, I wouldn't know, but he was a man in a responsible position. And I was directed to it. It was a little bit outside of Lomain, a quarter of a mile outside of Lomain. And it was a big house with a moat round it, hence the name Chateau La Motte. A little humpty back bridge. I rode over there through the arch, and when I got inside, there was chickens flying all over with the sound of the bike, and Mademoiselle scattering left, right, and centre. You know, because, I mean, when you see a 500cc bike turn into a compound, it is astonishing, I suppose. And asked for the monsieur, you know, the man, he came out and took us inside. And first time I had red wine. A red wine, chicken, and something else, I forget now, but he made us comfortable. Then he fitted me up with some sleeping quarters. I think the ghost must have slept in there because it stunk. And I stayed there about a week. Then out came Captain Gregson, the signal officer, with a small party. And we moved into a barn from there.
And what was the role of, what was the purpose of coming to No Mains in the first place?
Really, it was allocation of accommodation, requisition barns and vacated houses, because lots of people had left.
Were you actually involved in that process?
Not in a sense, not really. The first, second day I went round with this official, and he was showing me barns and assessing how many troops they will hold. And we come to some terms, you know, 16 or 30 or whatever, it was 20, you know, and here a clipboard, which I brought out, documentation which I brought out, and he was marking off. Then I was chalking the doors, like A company in one platoon, you know. It wasn't official duty as such. I had done my duty by delivering the dispatch. I was just a hanger-on.
Did you give him... Sorry.
But there was occasion when he came to the battalion headquarters, you know, and I didn't think that Colonel Yates would have liked being there.
Where had he put Colonel Yates?
Well, it was a wheelwright's workshop,